What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Many of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, which is my effort to find the most interesting people in the world and sit with them for hours while I ask questions in an effort to learn. So it would mean the world to me if you would subscribe to the show on your favorite audio platform, watch episodes on YouTube, and tell your friends and family about the podcast. My goal is to help millions learn from the world's most interesting people. So let's get into today's episode. Today's episode is with Chris Dixon. He is the founder and managing partner at A16Z Crypto, and he is the author of a brand new book called Read, Write, Own, Building the Next Era of the Internet. In this conversation, we talk about the original promise of the internet, what went wrong, why so few companies actually control everything you do in the digital world, how blockchains and crypto can change that, why he's a big fan of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and many other blockchains that you've heard of. And then we get into how crypto is going to intersect with artificial intelligence and other technologies, what's going on with the policymakers, and lastly, how is the actual employee base going to grow and what we need in terms of headcount to go ahead and keep this industry rolling. I always enjoy talking to Chris. He is very thoughtful about what he's doing, where he's investing capital, and how the industry is developing. This conversation is no different. Hope you learn a ton. Here is my conversation with Chris Dixon.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Today's episode is brought to you by iTrust Capital. Are you buying crypto on an exchange because you're excited about the bull run? Well, I hope you're reporting your crypto gains to the IRS because they want you to pay your taxes. That's right. When you buy and sell crypto on an exchange, you need to pay the government taxes when you make profits. That sounds pretty taxing. There's another way you can buy and sell crypto without worrying about taxes. At iTrust Capital, you can buy and sell crypto inside of a tax-advantaged crypto IRA. Crypto IRAs are retirement accounts that work similarly to an exchange, but with tax benefits. Let me give you an example. If you can buy and sell crypto on an exchange and you make a $20,000 profit, you have to pay the government taxes. However, if you do the same thing in your Roth IRA and you make a $20,000 profit, you don't need to pay any taxes. That's right. You get to keep all the profits and not have to pay taxes because it's in a tax-advantaged account. So opening a tax-advantaged IRA at iTrust Capital only takes a few minutes. You have 24/7 access to the markets with some of the lowest fees in the industry. The bull run has begun, and people are starting to see their accounts go up. So start taking advantage of tax benefits with an IRA at iTrust Capital. You can start maximizing your crypto investment today. Go to itrustcapital.com. That's itrustcapital.com. Today's episode is brought to you by Core Scientific. They are one of the largest public Bitcoin mining companies and hosting solutions in North America. They specialize in transforming energy into high-value compute with exceptional efficiency at scale, and recently announced a contract with CoreWeave, a leader in AI cloud compute, to provide up to 16 megawatts of data center capacity. With a substantial fleet of their own miners, Core Scientific not only earns Bitcoin for their own account, but also provides hosting services for large-scale Bitcoin mining customers, operating out of 7 data centers in Georgia, Kentucky, North Carolina, North Dakota, and Texas. You can learn more about Core Scientific by visiting corescientific.com. That's corescientific.com. Go check them out today. All right, guys. Bang, bang. I've got Chris here with me. Chris has written a fantastic book called Read, Write, Own, Building the Next Era of the Internet. Highly suggest that you go and check it out. Chris, the entire premise of the book is that there's been these three kind of eras of the internet. Maybe the most interesting part to me of like the history component of it was like what the internet was intended to be. And yeah, you've had this, you know, 25-year storied career investing in technology. Like, how do you look at now with the benefit of hindsight, what was the internet trying to do and how much of that vision did we fulfill?
Yeah, I mean, so the internet began as an open and decentralized network that came out of originally government and academia. That was why I was really attracted to it in the beginning and sort of the late 90s when I got involved. The idea, you know, sort of inevitable in some ways that we would connect all the computers in the world. But the fact that we did it in this decentralized way where there was no owner, no gatekeeper, no one taking a toll, no company behind it, was a really exciting idea. And that enabled, I think that enabled a whole bunch of things, including a big wave of innovation in the 90s and 2000s, right? Because you knew, you know, if you created a website, for example, you owned that website, you truly owned it. There was no one sitting in the middle. There was no kind of app store taking 30% or Mark Zuckerberg taking, you know, charging you ads. You owned it, and therefore you could build some, you know, you could build a personal website, or a creator could build an audience, you know, an audience and have a direct relationship with the audience, or you could build Facebook and Google, right? And so that kind of decentralized structure that enabled ownership, people to own websites and own direct relationship with their audiences, enabled and unlocked all this innovation. And then in the 2000s, you know, I think a lot of good things happened. The internet got more advanced. We got social media. You know, the reason it's called Read Write Own, the read write comes is a common term people use to describe sort of the read era of the internet is the 90s, where the internet democratized the consumption of information. In the 2000s, the internet democratized not only the consumption, but the publishing of information. Anyone could create a blog. You know, the rise of Twitter and Facebook and social media let anyone publish. And that was a great thing in the 2000s, right? So we had, I think the internet got very powerful. We got broadband, we got mobile. But the trade we made is along the way is that we essentially handed power over to 5 to 10 companies who today control 95% of the internet traffic and the money flowing to the internet. I see blockchains as a way to build a new wave of internet services that like the early internet enable digital ownership and let us, I hope, build a new wave of internet services that kind of combine the best of both worlds, so that the spirit of the early internet, open decentralized networks, but the advanced functionality we've come to know and love on the modern internet. And all of this, of course, and I go through in the book, came out of Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin was the original blockchain network, and it still is a very important and powerful network. You know, what's so special about Bitcoin, right, is there's many things special about it. You can think of it as digital gold and sort of an inflation hedge, but it's the first large scale internet service that has no one running it. I mean, it's run by the community, and that's just a really profound and powerful idea that, you know, when I sort of fully understood it, realized, you know, could be the foundation of a new era of the internet.
So what's interesting to me is, like, it feels like, you know, Bitcoin had this big breakthrough, obviously this computational science problem that everyone was trying to solve for 40 years. Okay, we get it. Vitalik watches that, very interested in Bitcoin, then says, wait a minute, what if I take this and, you know, I add more expressiveness to it, and we can kind of do different things with smart contracts, etc. But now it almost feels like there's like a boomerang. Like, there's been a bunch of innovation and progress in the non-Bitcoin blockchains, but now people are trying to like build back onto Bitcoin, right? With like mm-hmm. sidechains and L2s and like all this stuff. And so How do you just think about, and whether it's as a builder or kind of with the investor hat on, you know, how much of these use cases can a single technical stack or a blockchain solve, right? Or kind of service?
Yeah.
Like, is it a thing where, you know, 5 internet protocols can serve tons and tons of use cases, the same thing can happen with a single blockchain, or actually we're going to get more specialization on these?
Yeah. Great question. I mean, you know, Bitcoin has a lot of advantages, right? It's the most secure blockchain. It's the most battle tested. It's got a great community. There are, you know, the developers did decide to make a set of trade-offs. So they kind of prioritize security and stability over things like performance. So, you know, you have 10-minute block times, probabilistic finality, you know, just sort of some limitation. So if you want to build, for example, a social network or something where, you know, the cost per transaction on the L1 on the base layer Bitcoin could be high. So if you want to build something like a social network, that it's, you know, that's probably better done on a different blockchain, like on Ethereum L2 or Solana, just because those blockchains prioritize performance over the other characteristics. But for financial thing, you know, like for a financial application, you really want that security, and there's nothing as secure as Bitcoin. So I think of it as a trade-off space, and I think this is sort of true of a lot of computing, where, you know, for different applications, you may want different things, and it makes sense to have, you know, you don't want 1,000 blockchains probably, but it probably makes sense to have a few for different uses. So games and social networks, right? It might be super high performance, low latency, low cost, financial, you'd have a different set of trade-offs and so forth, right? I mean, it also, of course, depends on the Bitcoin roadmap. I mean, what the developers decide to do, if they decide to add more opcodes, things like that. But yeah, but there definitely has been a lot of exciting stuff happening in Bitcoin lately, you know, with the things you mentioned, ordinals, L2s, et cetera.
And one of the things, I'm probably not as bullish as many other people are in terms of that stuff being successful. It almost feels like you're trying to take the innovations elsewhere, port it on top of, some of it'll work, but, you know, kind of if Bitcoin just becomes digital gold, like that's pretty good use case and be pretty big and successful, and people who hold Bitcoin will, you know, do all right. Right. It's kind of about my thought process.
I see Bitcoin is already successful. I mean, in my view, and it's just sort of probably going to, you know, continue to be, right. I mean, it's as much as digital gold, I mean, especially with the ETF and just sort of the brand awareness around the world, like, you know, it seems to have replaced gold as that for that use case.
Now, when we go to these other chains, one of the things that I think was the narrative was like decentralization is really important. Obviously, this whole idea of like owning the assets and the community was a big part of it. And then I was surprised. If you remember when like Binance Smart Chain, I think was the first time I saw it launched, and they basically were like, we're not decentralized at all. We're just like super fast and cheap. And some portion of developers would move over. And then we saw this happen again and again and again. And people would basically say, we're decentralized enough, or, you know, we're not decentralized at all, but we're using a similar technology. Like, how do you think through performance versus that security and that decentralization? And like, is it use case dependent, or is there some threshold that you think, in order to survive and kind of be resilient, these blockchains are going to have to reach technical architecture that is different than a centralized system?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I'd say a couple of things. Like, one, with respect to things like Binance, like, I think people don't, you know, people care about decentralization when it really matters. And so, you know, you obviously had, you know, 2 years ago, a bunch of situations where you had bad actors. Like, if you look at, like, you compare, let's say, DeFi to FTX or something, right? FTX, you know, because it's centralized, you had to trust the people behind it, who, of course, in the end, you turns out you couldn't trust, right? Whereas with truly decentralized networks, like, let's say, Uniswap built on top of Ethereum, it doesn't matter whether you trust the founders and things, right? So some of these things, like, they're like, they matter when they matter, right? Like, and it may seem like Binance Smart Chain is okay and just as good as Ethereum for a while, but then at some point some catastrophic bug happens, some bad actor happens, and you really experience the difference, right? Like, that could not happen on a well-designed blockchain, those kinds of incidents, right? So sometimes I think people kind of, especially in like the frothy times, probably lower their, you know, kind of lower their diligence threshold or something on these things. But I do think ultimately it's very, you know, these principles are very important, because just, it's just human nature that if you, you know, that you sort of, like, I have a section on this in the book, that when you kind of create a new network, a new internet service, you always start off, because you're an entrepreneur and you're a startup, you know, whether it's a blockchain network or a website, you start off kind of trying to get users on, being super friendly. But then as you gain power, and we've seen this over the last 20 years of the internet, more and more you start to extract. I call it the attract extract cycle, right? And so as you get, you know, as Facebook got bigger, as Google got, look at Google, just to give you an anecdotal example, you know, when Google started off, they were famous for having no ads on the page, and then they had one ad on the page, and they made a big thing about it. Don't be evil, don't put more ads. You go today, and it's like, for many searches, the whole page is Google properties and ads, right? And that's the logic of, they've built a successful service, and now they're extracting as much as they can out of it, right? One of the core concepts of decentralization is that you can't do that, right? It's, I like to say, can't be evil instead of don't be evil, right? And so in the beginning, sometimes these differences aren't as apparent, but over time, as bad things happen, as services gain power, they start to exploit their users. And the big, so you really start to see the differences and the importance of decentralization, I believe, over time. And that can kind of trick people, you know, because they can overlook it in the beginning, but it really matters ultimately, longer term, how these things are built.
How much
that answer your question?
Yeah. How much of those decisions, take Google as an example, is like because it's a publicly traded company and the like economic incentives and the shareholders wanting a return, et cetera, versus, you know, these blockchains, like there is an economic incentive at play, but it's a little bit different because there's not quarterly reports. There's, you know, kind of just a different mechanism at play.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's exactly right. I think it's all about sort of the system and the incentives, right? So I don't blame Google for this, right? It's just like if you go read the Wall Street reports will say we need them to grow 20% year over year to maintain their stock price, right? And then the problem they, and this is true of all the big tech companies, the problem the big tech companies have is they've run out of people. Like they've just, you know, they kind of, they're at the top of the S curve. They've gotten all the, they've gotten most of the users. It's growing, you know, the number of users growing, but not at the rate that Wall Street wants. And so the only way to get that number, right, that growth rate is to increase the monetization, to put more ads on the page, things like that. So I don't blame them, you know, and then that kind of, and that logic flows down. Then the CEO needs to do it. And look, the CEO might resist for a while, and maybe a founder CEO like Zuckerberg could resist. But if you're a hired CEO, you know, you're ultimately going to get fired if you don't, if the stock price drops. And then that trickles down to management, and everyone's, you know, all the employees are paid with stock options. And so they all want to see the stock go up. And so the whole system is designed around just endless. You need to have endless growth. And because they have full control, because these centralized services have full control, that inevitably leads to kind of squeezing more juice out of the stone, right? Squeezing more. And that's what we're seeing on the internet today. I think internet services are all getting systematically worse, getting cluttered with ads, getting, you know, they're doing, now you're seeing like, you know, on all these social networks, they're like punishing you if you link out and if you've had this happen. Mm-hmm. That's just the same kind of logic, right? They just need to keep, now that they've switched from, because they've run out of kind of user growth, they have to switch to more time on site, more time in the app. And so it just leads to these really bad incentives. So it's a systems problem, I argue. I know these people, a lot of these people, these companies, I don't think they have bad intentions, but it's an incentive problem. And so blockchains switch the incentives and they lock in. You lock in the rules ahead of time, right? You can't go, and the Bitcoin developers or the community can't, they just can't go, and they just aren't allowed. They just, the system won't let them go and mess with the way the system works and be exploitive, right? And again, not that they would intend to do that or bad people, but just like, it's just better to have those rules baked into the system, right? And so that lets you build a whole, that's kind of my core thesis, is that lets you build a new wave of internet services where, you know, it sort of can't be evil and the rules are baked in. And that has all sorts of, and I talk about this in the book, I have in multiple sections, that has economic impact. That means, for example, there's a concept in internet services called take rates, right? If you have a market, take rate is the percentage of money that flows through a network that the network owner takes. So like Uber has a take rate and Facebook has a take rate and they take a certain percentage. The take rates on the internet today are extremely high. Like Facebook's take rate is 100%. App Store, like ask any app developer, they're all, you know, they're miserable about this. Apple takes 30%. It's very hard to run a business where you pay 30% for just showing up, for not really doing anything, right? And so, you know, one of the interesting things blockchains can do, like you can build a social network on a blockchain, for example, or a game or a financial service where you commit to better economics for the users and for the businesses who build on top, as an example. You can commit to rules for software developers. If you build on top of a network like Bitcoin or Ethereum, like you can build a business, right? You could build like a real L2 bit because you know what the rules are, and you know, there's no API that can change. So anyone who lived through the last 15 years of the internet will tell you there was a huge wave of developers building on networks like Facebook and Twitter. I don't know if you were around for this, but it was around 2012. They all kind of at the same time deprecated their APIs and just killed off a whole sector of the internet economy because they decided, you know, there was this big, I mean, there were hundreds of startups built on Twitter. Twitter didn't even have an app for the first 6 years. They just had other people build clients, and then they acquired an app and then shut off the other apps, right? And that's their right to do that. Like they're a company and they can control it, but a lot of people felt, a lot of software developers felt rugged. And I would argue it hurt the internet, because the internet's about, you know, what's so cool about the internet, going back to the beginning of our conversation, is that you can have this sort of diverse, creative community that all kind of comes together and builds software together and creates, you know, music and art and all these other kinds of things. And you know, ideally you have money flowing to the edges of the network that small businesses and creators and others can make a good living. And I think a lot of, you know, because we went the wrong way kind of, and because we've passed power to these five companies, we've lost a lot of that, those kind of original, promises of the internet. So
one of the things that's interesting to me is, like, you're talking about this idea of, like, almost like code is law, right? At least in practice, mm-hmm. in terms of the rules are written, they can't be changed. Mm-hmm. And when the community runs the place, or the community kind of owns the place, I've had the experience where, you know, I meet a founder and they say, oh, we want to do something together. You want to invest, you want to participate, you want to whatever. And I always tell a story that one time they're like, let's get on a Discord call with the community. And I got on a call and there's like literally 1,000 people on the call. And I was like, how do decisions get done? So I joke that, you know, if you had to put a vote to Amazon employees every time Amazon wanted to make a decision, it'd be pretty difficult. And so where do you see the balance of, like, the positives around, you know, the code is law and kind of how things are governed? But there's also, like, decision makings where humans have some degree of decision making. And so what are the solutions maybe that you're seeing there that are working right now?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because I have a chapter called Network Governance on this, and I opened it with the Winston Churchill quote, great quote, the only thing worse than democracy is every other system every other system of government. So first I'll say that, you know, this is a 2,000 or 5,000 year old problem offline how to get this stuff to work. So it's not, so there's no silver bullet here, obviously. I think one of the things that blockchains let you do that's interesting is you can encode the governance in software. Right. And so you can say, here are the rules. Right. And that doesn't mean it's a silver bullet to solve governance, but you can start to really kind of write down kind of constitution, so to speak. And people have done interesting things. So, you know, the sort of original, I mean, so like you have things like Bitcoin and Ethereum, which are what, you know, called off-chain governance, which means effectively it's governed by the software developers and the, you know, like which the nodes and the miners decide which fork of the software to upgrade to or what features to support. And then you had sort of this movement like 5 years ago or so to do what's called on-chain governance, which is more like if you have a token, you can vote on something. And that led to kind of what you're describing, which is kind of a little bit of chaos. You know, you'd have 1,000 people on Discord. And I think people are now, you know, you're sort of speed running 2,000 years of human history where people are now doing kind of representative democracies, you know, where you have a appointed group from the, you know, so it's ultimately the power flows to the people, but you have a representative group that does stuff. There's other people, like there's a layer two called Optimism that we're involved with that has kind of a bicameral system. So like they have kind of the house and the Senate, so to speak. And so the Senate is sort of trusted founded. So people are doing interesting experiments. Going back to the Churchill quote, I think what I do believe very strongly is having a single person, you know, whether it's, you know, just a single CEO of a social network, you know, like just take social networking, it's just one example, but, or financial networks. Those are both good examples. Those are incredibly powerful and important services. Who controls PayPal? Who controls Facebook? Who controls Twitter? Like 10 years ago, those seemed like not nearly as important. Now we've seen they can affect politics, people's lives, people's businesses. Like these are critical infrastructure. And I just very strongly believe that they should not be controlled by a very small set of people who happen to build that infrastructure. It'd be kind of like if AT&T got to decide who made phone calls back in the 1950s or something. Like these are too important to have them just to give all that power to those small set of people. And so, you know, I think that, you know, like, and there's no, again, there's no silver bullet, but having systems that somehow the power flows back to the community of users feels like a much better answer. And I think it'll probably land somewhere like it has in the real world, where you have some kind of voting or some system like that, effective voting, and then some representative group who does stuff, because it's just too chaotic to have 1,000 people on the Discord yelling at you.
It was a learning experience for sure. You're mentioning almost like a recreation of, you know, the United States governance, kind of the political process, et cetera. And we got plenty of problems, but also to your point, there's no better system so far. Most of the governance that I've seen and most of the blockchains, they're dealing with digital assets. So these are things that are natively digital, whether they're trying to recreate things that are, you know, in the kind of physical world, or they literally are newly created in the digital world. How much of blockchains and kind of this governance model and the idea of democratization and kind of this own component of rewrite own can be applied to the physical world, right? We see people trying to do deeds to homes or, you know, various things that are trying to tether it. But what have you all seen there that's either working or do you have a thesis that maybe it won't work?
No, I think that's very exciting and very important. I think that the big blocker, honestly, is regulatory, is sort of the policy stuff. You took the example of deeds, right? You need to have a framework for like, how do you adjudicate that? How do you enforce it? Like you need the offline legal world to recognize those deeds. People talk about, you know, tokenization of real world assets like stocks and all those. You know, there's just, look, I mean, and look, the challenge candidly is just that the current regulators have just basically been doing everything they can to sort of stifle crypto and blockchains. And so they've made it difficult. And then you have these financial institutions that would be important players here, who are, you know, banks and, you know, the BlackRocks of the world, the Goldman Sachs of the world, who up until recently have just been kind of afraid to enter the space. Mm-hmm. I think that's starting to change. And I think that's very promising. And we would love to see that and work with them. The digital world is very important, but the offline world is still the majority of the economy and people's assets. And I think there's a lot of benefits to you know, having those intersect and use blockchains. And so I think the earliest one we've seen is like USDC, the stable coins. I mean, right, that's a quote real world asset. You're taking a USDC token represents a dollar that sits in a bank account. And here's the promising thing. Like there's a stable coin bill that I think has a decent shot of getting passed this year or next year. And that will just clarify all of that and then allow all of those institutions to enter that space. And I think provides a template then for, like, you could imagine after the stablecoin bill, you have a real world assets bill, right? And we're working very, I spend a lot of time on this. We work very hard on this. But I think that's the big blocker, honestly. I think people that say, oh, this is disappointing, why haven't blockchains done that? It's not really a fair critique, because it's just it just hasn't been allowed up until now. I think it will. I think it's inevitable over time. These systems are just clearly better ways. I mean, you still, tons of Wall Street still runs on like Bloomberg chat messages and things. Like, it just has not been modernized. And look, a lot of it, I think a lot of these problems are actually, they're coordination problems, right? Like, let's just say you have 10 banks who today, you know, they trade using like so-called dark pools, you know, where they're chat, you know, just the sort of no exchange, they're just sending messages and things. How do you get those 10 banks to agree on a standard and work together, right? Or you mentioned mortgages, like how do you get all the different disparate mortgage related institutions to agree on something, right? And to work together on a common system. One way to do that is someone creates a company, but then people, you know, you create a startup that does that. The problem is those institutions are going to be really wary of giving over that kind of power to a company, because they have, there's a long history. You know, Visa and MasterCard started as nonprofit consortiums and now are for-profit companies that take a big chunk of that money. And so you talk to the folks like the banks and they're like, we're not going to do that again. One of the beautiful things with the blockchain, right, is you have this neutral, credibly neutral intermediary that they can all trust, that they can say, hey, I know that blockchain's not going to rug me. It's not going to change the rules. It's not going to hand power to my competitor. So I think it's a very powerful, blockchains are a very powerful tool for that use case. We just need more regulatory clarity, and we're working very hard on it. And I'm hopeful. And I think we'll, in the next year or two, get there. The other thing I'd say is, you know, I think you've seen with the Bitcoin ETF, the bit flip a little bit, where a lot of these institutions, instead of looking at things out of fear, are now seeing business models. I mean, the ETF is, you know, has been wildly successful in terms of inflows and things. And I think, you know, like Wall Street, you know, is very, as you might guess, very profit oriented. And I think they're starting to realize that this might be a place that they can make profits. And so that, I hope, is sort of step one. And then they sort of say, hey, what if we embrace blockchains more broadly? Could this be an important new line of business? So, and I think that's changed, that sentiment is changing from the people I talk to.
One of the areas that also is very important for these things to be successful is the funding of them. And so obviously we kind of went from, you know, Bitcoin's launch, there was no real kind of quote unquote funding. Then we get the ICOs. And I think people are trying to figure out like the IPO, the crowdfunding, like how do we kind of mash these things together? The venture business obviously became very big. And now I think that if you go to like the other end of the extreme, you have like these meme coins that are like being launched. You know, I think I saw a stat that there was 2,500 meme coins launched on Solana in an hour. Right. Just like insane. You press a couple buttons, you can put these things out there. They end up getting tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars from market cap. And so how do you think about funding the things that actually are going to matter, and how much of it is like, venture capital type funding versus you actually want to use the community and there's like some incentive or governance component that ties into this?
Yeah, I mean, the meme coin thing, look, I find that frustrating as well. I actually just wrote an op-ed that I hope will come out soon. It's that's a regulatory failure. So if you look, meme coins are legal. Meme coins are completely legal. There's no debate whether they're legal. The debate is when you take a meme coin and start adding utility to it, is when the SEC would claim you're now at risk of being a security. Okay, so like literally, like Robinhood lists Dogecoin, but not Solana. So this is, I find, very frustrating, is that we've essentially, from a policy point of view, and if you go look at the Coinbase lawsuit stuff, you know, it's all about is there a team trying to make this token useful? That becomes the issue. So we've designed a policy system, or have a policy regime and have agencies who are enforcing a regime, which disincentivizes, I would argue, productive applications, which is very frustrating. That's the meme coin thing. There's no law or even theory. Like I was just talking to our legal team about it. There's not even a theory as to how they would, you know, someone would stop meme coins. That's what's happening, is people just, they don't want to get, you know, sued by the SEC. So they make it as dumb as possible. Like this is the incentive. And this is just, and like my core argument, part of why I wrote the book, is that I think that with technology that, you know, the internet has, I think it's just changed a lot of things in the world and requires new policy. And I think the right way to do policy, right, is to look at a new technology, whether it's blockchains or AI, holistically, and say, okay, there's good things you can do with it. And that's what I try to describe in the book, is like the productive use cases of blockchains. And I think that's what you're describing now. And then there's bad stuff you can do with it. And let's design a policy that maximizes the good and minimizes the bad, sort of a proactive policy. Instead, we just have a lot of kind of tribalism and name calling and lawsuits, and it's just not productive, right? And what does it do to entrepreneurs? Like if you're an entrepreneur, they want to work on products. They don't want to spend their time talking to lawyers and getting, you know, in the middle of lawsuits. And so any kind of gray area, which is what we have a lot of around blockchains now, is a disincentive to work in the space. And they just go off and create a chatbot or whatever people are doing now in other areas, right? So that's, it goes back to that, the policy stuff, which is, you know, I'm now spending like half my time on this stuff because I just feel like it's essential and important. And I think it's important that the US be the leader in this space, and we have all the people here and all of the wherewithal. We just need to kind of shift the incentives around the regulatory side to, I think, make it work.
What is the reception to you specifically, in the sense of, like, on one hand, you're an expert, right? And probably in their eyes, and like, you've invested a lot, you know, a lot of the different players, you spend a lot of time on it. On the other hand, like, you're an investor, and I'm sure somebody accuses you of like talking your book and, you know, oh, you're only interested in this because you guys have a fund in the space. Like, how do you all think about the interfacing with regulators, and are there things that you've seen that can help build some common ground or common understanding that really kind of resonates with them?
I'd say it really varies across the spectrum, just depending on their politics. But we're working a lot. We have a lot of, for example, like people think of this as like a Republican Democratic issue. It's not. We have a lot of Democratic supporters. They tend to be kind of pro tech Democrats. I think generally like the kind of Congress is, you know, generally open minded in my experience and generally supportive. It's another thing to actually get a bill passed, you know, just all the process of all that. But the way I kind of describe it, I say, look, of course I'm talking my book, like in the sense I'm obviously I have an interest, but I argue that, look, my interest is, you know, we're a venture capital firm. We depend on a vibrant startup economy to have a business, and having an internet controlled by five companies is not good for venture capital. And I argue, you may say I'm self-interested, but I would argue my interests in this case are also America's interests, right? I think we all agree that America wants a vibrant internet, a vibrant startup economy. So I kind of describe it as most people in Washington, they sort of see you walk in the door and they say, oh, here's tech. But I point out that most people they meet with are actually big tech. We're one of the few kind of scaled institutions that goes that interacts with policymakers who represents little tech. We want to see startups succeed. You know, most of our time is spent with small startups, and we want to see, and look, venture capital depends on this sort of constant dynamic, sort of the wheel spinning, and the U.S. economy does. You know, the U.S. economy, I forget the latest stats, but like it's just in a constant state of, you know, creating and destroying jobs. I mean, the way that we keep unemployment low, you know, with new and also embrace new ways of technologies is, yes, there will be jobs that are destroyed, but hopefully we will create many more jobs. And we primarily, the data shows, do that through startups, right? Yeah. So I basically argue, yes, of course I'm self-interested in that sense, but I believe my interests, sort of venture capital's interests and society's interests align in this case.
How do you think about the percentage of money that these startups are spending on legal and regulatory? And I think a lot about, big companies, they have to spend a lot of money on that. They got a lot to protect. Usually in traditional venture capital kind of backed companies, they don't spend that much on it because it's just get something into the market, make sure that it works, you know, find product market fit and then start to scale and worry about that stuff. This industry feels different. And so do you guys have like a percentage in your head or how do you guys just think about how many dollars are going to that?
I mean, if you do a $10 million Series A, it's at least a couple million is going to legal. And then, but there's that. And then there's the attention spent by the, you know, by the CEO and the founders, just the time spent, which is very hard to quantify, just, you know, the kind of stress and mental energy. And then, but I think even probably the biggest thing is in the products they can't build. I would say a third, if not more, of our portfolio has a really interesting product roadmap that they're just not going to build because there's too much uncertainty. They don't want to take that risk. And so just like all the things you're describing, we're talking about, there's just a lot of people who just won't do it because they see other people and, you know, spending their time on legal stuff, and people don't want to do that. So it's massive. I think my experience, when I talk to people outside of the industry, they don't realize how, you know, they sort of have this picture of this Wild West and, everyone's just building, and that obviously that exists, but that's mostly like offshore, single individuals, the meme coin stuff you described. Like none of the stuff in everything in the US that we're involved with, you know, their first thing they do is they get a top tier law firm, they hire a general counsel, they do deep research, and it's just a huge drag. I don't work directly in AI, my firm does. But you know, you see like the Biden executive order around AI, I don't know if you saw that, and there's like, he gives directives to 15 agencies to do things around AI. Like imagine a 10 person, and this happens with us, a 10 person startup getting subpoenas and requests from 15 agencies, right? Like the US is a very complex system. You've got, you know, 10 to 15 federal agencies that matter for most of these, for AI, crypto, et cetera. You've got states, you know, state issues. And you're talking like a 10 person startup, and you've got, you know, you're dealing with five or six or sometimes, you know, and at the same time. And again, these are nothing, they did nothing wrong. They're just getting inquiries. You have to respond to them. There's no actual like wrongdoing or anything like that, but it's just a massive kind of, time and energy suck.
How do you think about blockchains and kind of crypto as an industry interacting with some of these other areas? Like one of the things that early on, I think I got excited about was like Bitcoin could be money for machines, right? The 2-day settlement times of dollars is going to be pretty difficult. If you can actually send dollars back and forth as a stablecoin or Bitcoin, that could be pretty interesting. Now with artificial intelligence, it feels like those systems really eat on data. Living in this digital world, like, it feels like they should be connected in some way, but are you guys seeing that, or are they still pretty separate and distinct?
Yeah, there's definitely people doing like kind of intersection of AI and blockchains. Like we have a couple investments. One is doing sort of like crowdsourced GPU compute, kind of like Airbnb for GPUs. Someone can put their GPU online and someone else can access a network of GPUs as an example. And there's a bunch of stuff like that. But I would say generally my experience in technology is that things do very much over intersect. And so just very briefly, the history of computing, you kind of every 10 to 15 years have a major wave, right? You had mainframe computers, mini computers, PCs, internet, mobile. Now I think we have AI, blockchains, et cetera. During the last wave, which I was very involved with, the 2008 to 12, let's call it, there really wasn't just mobile. There was mobile, social, and cloud. And it's, and by the way, if we were sitting here 15 years ago, people would be like, oh, these guys are saying buzzwords, you know, and I was, we were accused of that, but it was actually very true. They were important trends. But what happened is the three really heavily intersected, right? Like mobile to let you take devices from a couple hundred million desktops to 5 billion supercomputers in your pocket. Social is the killer app for phones. People spend 2.5 hours a day on social networks. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but they do. And so that's sort of the thing that, you know, the kind of the prime driver. And then cloud was the backend infrastructure that makes it possible. It makes, lets you build these services that, that, you know, let a billion people interact. And so they ended up really heavily intersecting. And I think the same thing will happen now. I think, and I think we're at a, I believe we're at the most exciting time, my lifetime, in the sense that you have AI, blockchains, new devices like VR, self-driving cars. You know, it's not an area I'm an expert on, but from what I'm here in sort of bio, you know, bioengineering and sort of the intersection of that and AI and things, it sounds like amazing stuff happening there. Robotics, like it's just going to be, you know, the space stuff. I don't know, like if you follow like the, you know, the sort of real world infrastructure, energy, it just feels like it's all, you know, it's like a movie where the, there were all of these like kind of, you know, building narratives that are all kind of coming together, you know, in the grand finale in some way. I mean, hopefully it's not the finale, but, you know, but like, you know, the big kind of, you know, all these things that kind of technical people have dreamed about are all becoming real. And so I think they'll heavily intersect is my view. And I think one of the challenges and opportunities is like, you know, AI will require all sorts of new services, right? There'll be new networks, new, you know, ways to, you know, both at the infrastructure level and the application level, and just all sorts of new services that you want. How will those be built? Will they be built in the kind of older way where you have a single CEO that controls it, or will they be built in more of a community blockchain way as an example? So, I think of it from like the blockchain perspective is like, we need to make sure that we have our act together. We have the policy stuff figured out. We have the infrastructure and all the tools figured out so that, you know, we can participate in a first class way with all of these other technologies as they're growing.
One of the frameworks that you use that I really like is like the computer versus the casino. And, you know, we talked a little bit meme coins and I go back and forth on this of, on one hand, yes, you want to build the computer and like forget the casino, but at the same time, like the casino may actually attract attention and capital into the ecosystem, which then can be used to build the computer. And so how do you think about maybe aspects that, you know, don't look sustainable, don't seem like they're kind of quote unquote serious, but do they have a benefit to potentially getting capital into an ecosystem and helping the builders, you know, kind of get users and the things they need to be successful?
Yeah, I mean, like the way I think about it is, I mean, you could like analogize it to other markets. So for example, you know, the housing market, right? So you have sort of the productive side of the housing market. Like why do we value home ownership as a society, right? So home ownership is important because it's, you know, emotionally to raise your family. It's important because it aligns incentives. People that own homes are more likely to contribute to their, you know, build their home and contribute to their community. And then we have housing markets and we have people speculating and I think we generally think speculation, and by the way, stock market works this way, right? I mean, you have speculation, but you also have the productive side, right? You have a way, it's a way to allocate capital to productive enterprises, right? So you have sort of all of these markets. I think when they're healthy, you have two sides to them, right? You do have the speculation and the, and that does create investment, as you say, and is does play a role, but you also have the productive side. And I think it's about the balance. Like I think when crypto fails is when it's all meme, right? If it's fun meme coins to fund something useful, sort of like the stock market when it's working well, that's okay, right? I mean, I think that's generally how we as a society have landed on the balance between the productive economy and the kind of the more speculative economy. So for me, like when I talk about the computer and the casino, around blockchains, that's sort of referring to the sort of two communities of like the speculators and the builders. I'm not anti-speculators. I'm just anti all when it's all speculation, right? There needs to be kind of a balance, right? There needs to be the two need to work together. I mean, like speculation, the reason you can find out what your home's worth on Zillow is because there's a liquid speculative market on homes. But again, like if you don't have the actual home ownership and all the good things that it implies, then it's just pure gambling, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. And then Fred Wilson wrote this nice blog post when your book first came out and he had asked you like, why'd you write the book? You got a lot of stuff going on. Are you spending all this time on policymakers, et cetera? Like why'd you write the book? And one of the answers of the two really caught my attention, which was like, you wanted to explain to the moms of a Coinbase engineer, like what basically why it was important what their kids were doing. And I think you use that as just like an anecdote to kind of say to people like, look, there's going to be talent that flows into these industries. And we actually probably need more talent. We need more people helping to build this out. And so what has been the reception from maybe that crowd? And like, what did you learn as you kind of writing the book?
Yeah, no. So I felt strongly that, and maybe you've experienced this, Pomp, that it's just a space that's very misunderstood. And having the bad incidents of 2 years ago, FTX, et cetera, you know, just a lot of people outside think it's all just speculation and scams. And obviously, you know, there's another side to it. And a lot of, you know, there's tens of thousands of people who work on this full time who believe very strongly in it. And I felt their voice, you know, hadn't been heard. And so, yeah, so the book was for your friends and family. And hopefully folks in crypto will learn something. I think like the younger people like I've heard a lot. They like the history. Other people just like the frameworks. But I've been very happy to hear that, you know, both in our portfolio and outside of our portfolio, people have told me that this is the book they now give to new employees and recommend to others. Like I saw Jeremy Allaire, who were not investors, and he's a great entrepreneur. We're unfortunately not investors in Circle, and he tweeted out that he's giving it out to every employee, and we've seen like a whole bunch of that. And that's great. And I also, you know, I mentioned I do a lot of go to DC a lot. Literally every meeting in DC, almost they say, "What book should I read?" I think, you know, folks in DC like books. They don't like they're not as into podcasts and blog posts and things. And so, you know, now I have a book to give them. So, you know, I want it to be, I feel like it's gone really, and I keep hearing, I hope you found that when you read it, that like, it's just very accessible. I tried very hard to make it accessible. I rewrote it many times to make it, you know, to give examples, and there's no technical words that aren't defined. I really try to avoid technical jargon. I think sometimes tech books can be hypey and technical and use, you know, buzzwords and things. And I really tried hard not to do that and just kind of tell stories and give examples. And I feel like that's worked. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, the response I've gotten has been very positive. So
what are the things that maybe you're most excited about in terms of like verticals or areas that if somebody's listening to this, you're trying to find something to invest in and haven't found it yet?
Yeah, I think there's things that are kind of at scale around blockchain. So, I mean, Bitcoin's the most obvious. And then I think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening with stable coins. I keep hearing more and more kind of both anecdotes and seeing data supporting the growth of stable coins, particularly in the developing world. So people in, you know, Argentina and places like this using USDC and Tether and others for settlement and payments and things like that. I think there were 600 billion in stable coin transactions last month, I believe. So that's interesting. I think that there's sort of these existing categories like, you know, the financial things like DeFi and real world assets. I think a lot of that the growth will depend on some of the regulatory things getting figured out. But I have a very expansive view of blockchains. Like I think anything that can be built, you know, any internet service can be built this way. There's an early but growing blockchain based social network called Farcaster that's interesting, that has a, you know, interesting feature where the economics are much better for the users. If you build a relationship with your audience, you can monetize, you can make money however you want. And the money doesn't flow to Twitter or Facebook, it flows to the creators. And you can, it enables software developers to build new features on top. And so we're seeing a lot of excitement around that. Gaming is interesting, video games, there's a bunch of interesting things there. Like we have one like called Pirate Nation. It's a sort of this what's called an on-chain game, and it's interesting because the users can actually own the assets that they earn. I think we had a first wave of games a couple of years ago based on blockchains, and some of them were just sort of too much about the financial aspects. Now we're seeing a new wave where people are building really interesting games. Games are always important in computing because they just, if you early mobile phones, games were a big driver of growth. Just generally, it's a great way to kind of get early users on board. The intersections with AI, as you mentioned, we're investors in a project called WorldCoin, which is co-founded by Sam Altman, which is trying to create an identity system on the internet. The idea being, in a world of AI, you can't tell if the email you got is from a real person or the video is a deep fake or real. And so you need sort of an identity system and a way to sort of attest to this is, I am Chris, I'm a real person. I can prove that cryptographically, and I can also prove this video is real. So that is just a couple examples off the top of my head. But, you know, I think just there's a whole wide range of things that intersect with new technologies, but also that kind of reimagine older technologies like social networks and games.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, I've put it out there a couple times and haven't found anyone yet, but it's kind of tangentially related, is like, if a blockchain is supposed to be this immutable thing that should last forever and be super resilient, do we start to put like books and records, and not like, you know, your company financials, but I joked that, you know, almost like the pioneers, right? You know, they used to carve into a tree and say, hey, we were here first. You know, people start writing things into the blockchain so that their ancestors could eventually look at it and say, hey, you know, my great-great-grandfather was, you know, early to this or something. But then also, as I've talked with folks, it's like, you know, your kid's born, right? Do you want to actually like stamp it into a blockchain? And like, how do you think about using these networks? The downside to it is like you could create, you know, kind of spam. You could actually change the economics of these blockchains. And so have you guys seen stuff there where it's not so much an economic or a governance thing, but it's more so just like this immutable record and people are trying to take offline, you know, information and really put it onto the blockchain?
I've seen it more in the digitally native context. So for example, there's a bunch of people where, you know, you can kind of prove that you're the first fan of this musician, right? Or, you know, sort of like you're the original, you know.
And the real OG.
Yeah, the real OG stuff. Like, so I've seen more digital things like that and kind of collectibles. And like with my book, we have an NFT that's sort of proof that you're one of the first. You know, it's fun. It's just a souvenir, but it's sort of a fun souvenir to show you're one of the first people, and people think it's fun. I mean, it's not, you know. So I think, you know, I think things like that are interesting. Like the digital world, unfortunately, has become, you know, most of the early internet is gone. The Internet Archive is kind of this, you know, attempt to save some of it. But the digital world's become very ephemeral, unfortunately. And like, I think things like Bitcoin, Ethereum, I think they certainly things you write to those blockchains will certainly be around longer than most digital items. And I think you can make the case will be around longer than most physical items. You know, it's very, you know, a blockchain will be around as long as a few nodes are running. And so, it seems very unlikely they'll go away. And so I think it's a very interesting place to record stuff like that. But yeah, so far most of it has been the things I've seen have been these kind of digital examples.
The book Read, Write, Own, Build in the Next Era of the Internet. Chris, it's fantastic. Anyone who has not yet, gone, read it, bought it, buy three copies. Why not? Send it to your friends. You did a fantastic job. I learned a lot from it, and I think other people will enjoy it as well. Where can we send people to find you on the internet if they want to keep up with your writing, tweeting, anything else?
Yeah, I'm Twitter, C. Dixon, like I mentioned, Farcaster, C. Dixon, and I'm pretty accessible. So thank you, and thanks so much for having me.